I'm Jo and I work as an assistant practitioner in a CAMHS service in Lancashire. I bought and read Marianne's book, The Clinical Psychologist Collective, to accompany me while completing the clinical psychology training application. It proved to be really good company. I found it sparked ideas of how to build experience and skills, but more than that, it offered the chance to get lost in people's stories. It provided a timely reminder not to get so caught up in an end goal and to value and enjoy each job we fulfil along the way, because the work we do now is important and matters to those we sit alongside, as well as ourselves. It also gave the reassurance that there are eclectic routes into clinical psychology, which is important for me as someone who's had a meandering journey and not a typical route to the profession. I wholeheartedly recommend the book for both personal and professional reasons. Be prepared to put evening tasks on hold for a while though, because once you've started reading, it's tough to put it down.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. With this podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast with Dr. Marianne Trent.
Hi, welcome along to the Aspiring Psychologist podcast. And today we're going to be thinking about compassion. Now, compassion is something that I think would have made my journey to being a clinical psychologist a whole heck more enjoyable had I discovered the practice of compassion before I actually did. So first off, I will tell you when I first kind of connected with compassion and also the close call I had. So let's start with the close call to begin with. So one of the kind of seminal texts on compassion is by Professor Paul Gilbert, who I have had the absolute joy of meeting for a two-day course. And I got there first. There was just him and I think just him and me in the room. And he came up to me and greeted me so warmly, including a handshake. This was pre-COVID times, and I had just walked from a train station in winter and I was absolutely freezing, and I felt so self-conscious of how cold my hands were, and also just completely like a rabbit in the headlights for the fact that Paul Gilbert was in front of me, you know, greeting me, welcoming me along to his course. And I also was thinking this course was going to be, you know, pretty massive. There was going to be loads of people in the room, and I was just hoping to blend in, really, and to just sit in the background and soak up his Professor Paul Gilbert brilliance. But it didn't turn out that way. There was probably only about 10 of us on there. And so it was a really intense day. It was a real privilege, you know, a real privilege. I loved it and I learned so much. But my first brush with Professor Paul Gilbert was when I was training. It might even been shortly after I was training, but I was at a house party for someone on my cohort. And these house parties, you know, I don't know how old you are listening to this podcast episode, but this is not like a house party like it was when I was at undergrad uni, you know, where you don't really know the person who's hosting it, you know, you stay up all night, you know, you have the time of your life. You drink some drink that's kind of orange, that's come out of a punch bowl, but you don't really know what's in it. And, you know, right now that might trigger you as well, because I know there's all sorts of sort of drink spiking things around. But, you know, growing up, this is the late 90s and early 2000s is when I was doing my undergrad. You know, I have very fond memories, and thankfully I came through it unscathed, apart from, drinking too much vodka and coke and things like that at sometimes. I don't even know why I did that because I don't like coke really. So anyway, so yes, I was at this house party, which definitely didn't involve bowls of punch, but probably did involve, stuffed vine leaves. It was that kind of party, but lovely. And on the sideboard in my friend's house, there was a copy of the very weighty tome, A Compassionate Mind by the said Professor Paul Gilbert. And it had been returned by someone who had read it. And they said, Marianne, would you like to read it? And I took one look at it, saw how thick it was, and I was like, no thanks. I wasn't really into reading workbooks for pleasure. I thought it would be really, really worky. And actually, when I came to read it, this would have been probably 2010, 2011, but I didn't come on to get to grips with compassionate theory until 2017, 2018, I'm going to say. And, had I had it in my life for that many years in the middle bit, and for the bit before I actually got on to the clinical training course, I think it would have been super useful for me, and I'd have had a much gentler ride. Because something I know that will resonate with many aspiring psychologists is that we can be our own harshest critic. And I think this fits in with some of the pop psychology around us being wounded healers. We're partly healing ourselves by entering into this profession. And I certainly think that it's really the best job in the world. I feel so grateful, so lucky to do this that I really love, So it doesn't feel like work a lot of the time, which is just, I'm very lucky in that regard, I think. And I know that many of you might feel the same as well. But we can, it can definitely ebb and flow. Sometimes it feels a lot more worky than others. And, we get those real golden nuggets of just incredible connection and knowing where you've made such a difference to the lives of people you've worked with, which is just, incredibly wonderful. So, yeah, part of our wounded healer mentality can be that actually, we're quite mean to ourselves at times. So discovering self-compassion for me earlier in the process, if I had picked up that weighty book off that sideboard, along with some posh dip and stuffed vine leaf, then it might have been really useful for me. And I think it would have been really useful for me as a new parent as well to have already welcomed self-compassion into my life. So if you don't know, you're not familiar with books on self-compassion, then I'd absolutely recommend the one by Professor Paul Gilbert, but also Dr. Chris Irons, the Compassionate Mind Approach to Difficult Feelings. That's the one that I really think is really accessible and really useful. So do check out those as a first port of call if you get if this piques your interest, I would say. So yeah, they're really useful books. And had I discovered those when I was a parent, I would have absolutely cut myself more slack. It's hard to do any job well, let alone be a new parent who, at one point I was waking up like 37 times a night with a screaming baby. It's kind of tricky. It's kind of tricky if you've got high expectations upon yourself. So, the reality is certainly if you have clinical psychology in your sights, that there aren't, you know, limitless places available. So I'm just taking a quick look at the book, The Clinical Psychologist Collective, here. And, you know, the success rates and the number of places, it's, you know, it's pretty sobering reading. So across the UK, funded places in 2021 were 979, with the applicants being 4,544. So the success rate that year was 22%. And of course, it is a little skewed because people will be applying who maybe have only just graduated. And so it would be less likely that they would be successful. So actually, if you do have a number of years experience and you might perhaps have a master's and done some published research, then actually your chance at success might be higher than 22%. Does that make sense? But yeah, the number of places was 979, and it was always, you know, on my radar how many places there were on the course that I wanted to apply for. And because I was doing my assistant psychologist roles in the Midlands, you know, the course that I ended up getting on, happily loving, had 15 places, 15, the year that I was successful. And so it was always in my mind, you know, if I help someone too much, or if I, you know, am too graceful and useful here, I could be talking myself out of a place and giving it to, you know, to them, which, oh, it's a really difficult, difficult position, because, you know, I adore my friends. I'm still in contact with many of them now. And yet, you know, it's difficult, isn't it, being a human? But also, you know, we've got this survival instinct. You know, at that point, if I'd had to choose who I'd prefer to get on a course, then I would have had to put in my secret ballot box rather than raising my hand. Me, I'd rather I got on to training, you know, and that's difficult because we want to have a really collaborative ethos, you know. And I think this is more commonly spoken about now, about how to, you know, how to remain compassionate to yourself and to others. And that actually, you know, there is room for everybody to do well and to, you know, to try and be their optimal best. And that, you know, this is something that my children struggle with as well. So my children are 8 and 5. You know, if I say to one of them, oh, gosh, you know, you've done that beautifully. What a wonderful picture. What a lovely little artist you are. Or, you know, I might say, oh, God, you're so funny. Oh, that's really made me laugh. The other one will say, I suppose I'm not funny, or I suppose I'm a terrible artist. And it's like, no, that's not true, you know. I try to introduce them to the concept of mutual exclusivity, which is a hard sell. We're just going to pause for this quick ad break here, and hopefully by the time we get back, we will find that you are less of a hard sell than the 8-year-old and 5-year-old are in terms of mutual exclusivity. I found that the Our Tricky Brain Kit really helps me as a clinician to bring the compassion-focused therapy theory to life in a way that my clients can really engage with and remember. So yeah, I'd recommend it. Yeah. So, as you might know, mutual exclusivity is the concept that things, can only operate a bit like a train track. So they can only operate as a parallel. So if I was a good artist, then it would mean someone else couldn't be a good artist. But of course, we know that those are not mutually exclusive concepts. We know that actually it's quite possible for people to be. For lots of people to be very good at art and for our artistic style to apply and appeal to different people as well. So some may say that I was the better artist, they'd be wrong because I'm dreadful. And others, beauty is in the eye of the beholder and all of that. Others might think that someone else is better artist, and they would likely be right because my art is abysmal. But so yes, I picked a bad example, but my kids like drawing, so that's a really nice thing. So the mutual exclusivity in clinical psychology is that I can have really useful skills and experiences to offer and useful techniques and things about me that makes me a good psychologist. But you can also have the same techniques, skills, and experiences, or different techniques, skills, and experiences. And you can also be, good psychologist too, because we have to be able to, hold space for others also doing good things and know that that doesn't detract from our own experience and our own validity and our own worth. Gosh, these are all terms that we learn about in psychology undergrad, aren't they? Validity and, ecological validity and normality and on all of that. And actually here I am using them to talk to you. So, the stuff we learn at undergrad and the stuff we learn at A level, if you did it, is super useful, and actually I still use many of the techniques and the theory that I learned at A level now, bystander effect and cognitive dissonance and things like that. They're really integral concepts. So, anyway, that's a bit of an aside, isn't it? But in terms of compassion, we can allow ourselves to be good enough and to know that we can't expect ourselves to be a genius at psychology if we are indeed, starting out, or if we've not done it before. We have to be able to give ourselves, the breathing space and the capacity and the permission, but also the kindness, really, to not get things right first time every time. And that cropped up recently for me on my second ever salsa lesson, because I was just not very good. But realistically, I was comparing myself to people who'd been doing it for years and were asking me to dance and spinning me around like I was on Strictly. And so, I was never going to come up very well, and it actually did take me sort of an hour or so until I was home to think, hold on, Marianne, come on. It's all right. You can't expect yourself to be an expert on your second lesson. And it's okay if your feet were a bit of a mess. It's okay if you were, feeling a bit overwhelmed at times. That's all right, because actually the people teaching you stuff were teaching you quite complicated moves. And when even the basic steps are kind of taking some headspace and some thinking, it's okay to find the complicated ones a little bit perplexing as well. So I am going back for lesson three next week, and I may still be rubbish. I likely will be, and my dancing is about as good as my artistry, but I'm all right with that, because I'm never going to be a professional dancer. Believe me, I am never going to be that, so I can both be a good psychologist and a terrible dancer, because the two are not mutually exclusive. I wouldn't have to be one or the other. So yeah, I would just allow yourself to appreciate where you are right now and to not be able to, for example, be expecting yourself to be a complete neuropsych wizard if you've never done neuropsych before. I remember when I was an assistant psychologist, I'd done some neuropsych with a client, and we were concerned about some of his functioning, and it involved sort of drawing a clock face. And my supervisor just really briefly came into the office afterwards and said, "Oh, look, you can see that actually he might have some visual impairment because he's only done it on one side, or he's got some sort of planning problems, or ran out of space." And I just thought, "Oh, yeah, I didn't really see that. I didn't really get that when I saw that." And I felt like, "Oh, like she's so good." And she is, but I'd never done it before, And so actually, I wasn't used to making, interpretations and trying to formulate about this particular, piece of neuropsych, or particular piece of, theory. And so just allowing yourself some breathing space, to allow yourself to grow, water yourself, and allow yourself to just, do what you need to do, and to know that you are supposed to be learning. Even when we are fortunate enough to get places on decline side courses, or whatever course it is that you're aspiring to, we are not expected to know it all, because we're not supposed to be the finished article. I feel like this is a massive topic, and we might well need to do another episode on this. And if you think that'd be useful, give me a shout. Please do, subscribe and review, and keep listening, and let me know any feedback you've got. And I will look forward to catching up with you on our next episode. Take care.
If you're looking to become a psychologist, then let this be your guide. This podcast at your side, you'll be on your way to being qualified. It's the Aspiring Psychologist Podcast with Dr. Marianne Trent.
Hello, my name is Veronika Kasova. I live in Edinburgh, and I just graduated with a Master's in Psychology of Mental Health. Marianne recommended me the Clinical Psychologist Collective when I was networking on LinkedIn, and I must say I love it. It is one of a kind. It's like a window into the lives of people on the path of becoming a psychologist. The stories are unique, honest, and filled with a kind of intangible wisdom only personal storytelling can uncover. A common thread in the stories I valued most was to be compassionate not only with others, but with myself too. Also, not fixating on becoming a psychologist, but enjoying life, growth, and the final results will come as a byproduct. Marianne, thank you for taking the time to collate all the stories. The book is a true gem, and I think every aspiring psychologist should have a copy on their shelf. Thank you.